happy Hall of Fame election day, such as it is. As you said and as you pointed out, we may not have anybody today, but still plenty to discuss.
Do you think Curt Schilling reaches the 75% support necessary to be inducted?
I don't. Right now, Ryan Thibodeau does such a great job of tracking all of the ballots, has Schilling at 75.3%. And last year, from the publicly available number to what the actual number was, he dropped 7%. So that would, if it's the same general trend, he'd be dropping to right around 68%. And the same is true for Bonds and Clemens, both of whom are under 75 and last year dropped even more than Schilling did. So I think that we are going to see no one elected today. I'd be very surprised if the number for Schilling is diminished by a smaller number than 7.3% from last year. Now, obviously, the conversation of late revolves around his comments about the January 6th insurrection of the U.S. Capitol. Of course, that was after the ballots were sent in. But I still think there are a lot of voters who have serious reservations about what he has said in the past, and his support, at the very least, at the very best, from his standpoint, is flat, and probably in the minds of some is going down.
I wish I'd talked to you before. I said a little earlier in the show I thought he might get in, but as you were talking, your point is well made, and I think it probably still stands, John, because I'm willing to bet that a lot of the people who don't want their ballot made public might be older voters who will not vote for Curt Schilling. Like, I know of a couple, and that may explain why there is that rather sharp decline between publicly available ballots and the other ballots.
Exactly. And it's interesting. I spoke yesterday with Bill Madden, of course, Hall of Fame writer from the New York Daily News. And Bill made the point, it's an interesting one, that he did not vote for Schilling this year. He had in the past, but that he would not do it this year. And his reasoning is that he wanted, as Scott and as you were mentioning earlier, he wanted those inductees, the Jeters and Ted Simmons and Larry Walker, to have their day apart from what would be sure to be a very controversial speech from Curt Schilling that they deserved because of the pandemic canceling last year's induction ceremony, that he wanted those players to have a day free of the negativity that is sure to follow Curt Schilling if and whenever he comes up to the dais. So it's an interesting point, and I certainly understand it, because next year, as Bill said, the writers are faced with what he is calling the ballot from hell, with A-Rod joining and David Ortiz as well. It's going to be very unique times ahead for the voting, no question about it. And I think in general, I do believe the most likely outcome of all is that it is Jeter and Walker and Ted Simmons and no one else in terms of living inductees there at the dais in Cooperstown this summer.
John, your point is well made, because one of the fears I had, and of course this didn't enter my thought process when I was voting because we hadn't lost as many Hall of Famers then as we have, but there's going to be an awful lot of empty chairs up there this year because of the number of Hall of Famers who were living that we've lost most recently, of course. Henry Aaron. And my nightmare scenario was what will probably be a very somber ceremony, even with Walker and Jeter. I'm sure Walker's got some funny lines and all that stuff. The idea that Curt Schilling might end up commandeering it, the idea that there would be an adverse reaction to Curt Schilling, that really gave me a lot of concern. Because I think, as I said, this is going to be a very somber Hall of Fame induction, and it's going to require a certain amount. It's going to require a certain amount of dignity that I'm not certain Curt Schilling can muster.
That's a very good point, and I think that this is a time for all of us who love baseball and who love the Hall of Fame. This is a time of reflection. To your point, it's a very somber year. And I think as we consider where the Hall is going, there are a lot of questions that are being asked about what the institution is going to look like and what it will do to have that continued relevance in the years to come. Because you're right, those legends that we're so used to seeing up on the dais won't be there, and it breaks your heart to think about it. And you consider as well Joe Morgan, who we lost, of course, last year.
Right.
He was a vice president of the Hall of Fame, was very involved in, I know Harold Reynolds made this point yesterday on MLB Network, very involved in making sure that as many of the living Hall of Famers as possible would come back every summer. He was kind of the team leader of our greatest team in the national pastime, the Hall of Famers. He was sort of that clubhouse leader to make sure everybody was coming back and staying in touch. And so there's going to have to now be a renewal, if you can, of a younger generation of Hall of Famers who had played maybe during the later 70s and the 80s, or perhaps even the 90s, who now need to take the reins and sort of be those touchstones to keep the Hall of Fame as a living and breathing place. And so it's a very tough time. It's a very somber, reflective time. And I think, Jeff, to your point, it's a time that I think the inductees' speeches will be very closely watched and I think probably monitored and just really emotionally experienced because of the real heartbreaking year that we've all experienced for everybody in the world, but especially I think for the baseball family as well.
With John Paul Morosi, and I don't ask this in an attempt to conflate it with any kind of censorship, John, but I just wonder, do you know if speeches, and most of the time with these guys there would be no concern, but are speeches vetted? And if somebody has a script that's agreed upon in this hypothetical scenario and they veer off of it while they're live up on the podium speaking, how is that handled? Would there be preparations in place for that in the event that Schilling gets inducted?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do think that the speeches are submitted in advance. I think it's a matter of courtesy, a matter of I think also just making sure that the speeches were fitting with the spirit of the occasion. As probably any of us that would be, you know, if you're asked to give an address, you really kind of do the best you can with it and prepare your script. We haven't quite had the circumstance where there was deep fears of someone going rogue in terms of what they're saying up at the podium. But I do think, as a matter of practice, the speeches are submitted and circulated for feedback and for I wouldn't say the word approval, but there's just an understanding of what's going to be set up there. And obviously, to your point, it's broadcast live on MLB Network here in the States. So there, I think, like anything else, there would be a monitor of the. Just the good taste of what's being said there. But to your point, I'm not sure that there is a beyond any sort of decency check on a microphone what actually you'd be able to do. It's a great question, and I do think there are some in the game who are a little bit wary of what Curt Schilling may say if and when he becomes a Hall of Famer.
John Paul Morosi of MLB Network with us on Leadoff. Scott MacArthur, Jeff Blair, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. All right, two-prong. Number one, how many games, regular season games, in the 2021 season? And number two, when does it start?
Well, Scott, obviously it's a great question because we're kind of working through this right now, and the reports of yesterday in the Cactus League making some statements that perhaps they would prefer there to be a delay to the start of spring training. But meanwhile, how about this? Right around the same time that that report came out, the letter was issued, there was an email in my inbox from Roger Dean Stadium, the Marlins and the Cardinals, about spring training tickets going on sale.
Mm-hmm.
How about that irony?
Yeah.
So in Florida, and even admittedly for Arizona, and Jeff Passan spoke with the director of the Cactus League, Bridget Binsbacher, yesterday about this, and sort of Bridget's comments after the initial report was that, hey, we'll be ready if, in fact, we actually start on time. So I still think that spring training, against all odds, will start on time in some form. And the players' union really is insistent on this 162-game season. And I think MLB is looking for ways to make it happen. I know it sounds perhaps difficult to pull it off, but what we're seeing now, obviously, the NHL and the NBA with some difficulty, but that was to be expected, operating right now in indoor sports in the middle of winter. I think baseball, with their experience last year, is cautiously optimistic that things will be able to move forward and that we'll have the standard number of games. But there's also the reality that Arizona right now, as we speak, has the second highest per capita rate of COVID-19 infections in the entire U.S. So this is obviously a very fluid situation.
John, can you explain from your point of view why this whole notion of trading the DH, the universal DH, for postseason, for an expanded postseason, why that it's become such a sticking point? Because honestly, I will admit, maybe I wasn't paying attention to it, but I, at the end of last season or whatever, the end of the 60 games, the end of the World Series, I thought the universal DH and expanded playoffs are here to stay. Yeah, I just assumed that everybody was kind of happy with it.
I agree, and it's an excellent question, Jeff. Here's what I would say. The key word on all of this is value. Just like in value in free agency, there is a value that the union is assessing to that expanded playoffs because they know how much MLB wants it. They know this is additional revenue at a time when media rights and a lot of other revenue streams are somewhat uncertain at the moment. And playoff games, we know, rate very well. And so we know that MLB wants this. The union's perspective is that the DH is an insufficient commodity to trade for that very valuable commodity of expanded playoffs. And so it's being subsumed in the larger back and forth over labor relations where we would all agree. I think it's in the best interest of the game. And I've seen the report made that, well, one of the reasons is that the union has some doubts, and I think Hannah Kaiser reported this, that the union, and this is the union's perspective, believes that expanding the playoffs would dilute the competitiveness and potentially disincentivize teams from spending. And the notion that you can make the playoffs while finishing seventh in your league would make you less likely to spend. I would actually take the opposite perspective on that. I think that teams, especially when we saw this past year, when it was not just a one-off wild card game, but actually a best-of-three series, teams and GMs spend money when they believe they've got a chance to make the playoffs and their marginal chances of doing it are improving, especially when it's an actual series and not a one-off wild card game. I think that we would see teams spend more. Obviously, right now in the middle of a pandemic, hard to do that, but I think in general, expanded playoffs, in my opinion, would lead to greater investment in rosters. And so I really think, guys, it just comes down to the union believing that their chip to spend, their approval for an expanded playoff, is worth more than the relatively small amount of increased money that would be spent right now on DHs like a Marcell Ozuna or a Nelson Cruz.
Do you think if the owners came back to the players and said, all right, we'll guarantee 162 games, it gets done like that?
I don't, Jeff, because
really?
I think that
okay.
the union believes right now that is the likely outcome, that they think they're going to get 162 this year. So I think that they would not necessarily negotiate in something that they believe they're already entitled to getting. So it's unfortunate, Jeff, because I think that what we saw the National Hockey League, two different things. Number one, of course, we saw there was the extension of the CBA. And number two, I'll never forget Gary Bettman, the first press conference that we saw back when they announced the return to play in the summer, one of the first things he did was he thanked Connor McDavid, Mark Scheifele. You could tell there was a real personal relationship there between the commissioner's office and the top players. We don't have that in baseball right now. And I also think that we're not seeing any evidence right now that in the midst of this crisis that the sides have taken this as a chance to extend the current CBA and prolong labor peace. It feels like right now that both sides are preparing for what's going to be a very tough negotiation as we get towards the late summer and fall.
With John Paul Morosi on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So to dumb this right down, to drill right down, owners on one side, players on the other, what is the most of the many, no doubt, but what is the most pressing issue for each side. What is each side looking to accomplish here with their stakes in the ground, perhaps deeper than at any point in almost 30 years?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think a couple things, Scott. So the players, they want their veteran players, their veteran free agents, I believe, to be paid in some form resembling the way the market, quote unquote, used to operate. Even though I think we would look back and say, wait a minute, does the Pujols deal make sense for the Angels? Did the Cano deal make sense for the Mariners and then later the Mets? These are legitimate questions, and so I think that the players want their membership to be fairly compensated according to what their expectations were / used to be. And the issue there is that a lot of very smart front offices say, wait a minute, were we really doing it right in the past? And when you're signing a free agent, even someone as talented as George Springer, when you're the Blue Jays, you're probably not necessarily getting that efficient dollar-for-dollar return. There's a reason why you're spending that money beyond the usual, because there's a real narrative reason to get that player. So I think you're just trying to see, if you're the union, they want to see more teams basically behave like the Jays are behaving right now. It's a real minority of clubs that are spending on talent, that are really stepping out there and adding to their club superstar level players like the Jays. That is the exception rather than the rule. I think the union wants to find a way to get that level of investment back to being the norm, and perhaps maybe earlier free agency, earlier salary arbitration, ways of getting their players money earlier in the process, because clearly MLB teams are valuing those years in your 20s at a much higher point than those after you turn the age of 30. And I think from MLB's perspective, it's protecting the revenue streams that were very carefully cultivated over the last generation, whether it's media revenues, advanced media revenues. I think keeping the game moving and keeping the revenue streams healthy across the board, obviously being able to grow the game internationally, but I think chiefly it's just those domestic revenues, finding ways to keep the game relevant. I think one of the things that I'm really looking at as both a parent and also someone who works in baseball is, what are the crowds going to look like once there are no restrictions, whenever that happens again? Are we still seeing senior citizens in the ballpark for safety reasons? Are we seeing young families there? Who is coming to the games? In what cities? And where do we have to really address the marketing level? That, to me, this is now the big question. The marketing things we've talked about for years, this is now going to be, I think, a very, very clear and present concern for the health of the game long term.